The world is changing in ways that affect your life and your business. Do you have the intelligence you need? Now, FP is offering Insider. With a new FP Insider subscription, you will get all of FP's content plus exclusive access to data-driven intelligence, power maps that distill complex issues, in-depth special reports, and conference calls on the biggest stories and trends. Get global insight you can bank on. Subscribe to FP Insider today at foreignpolicy.com/FP Insider.
From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, the Brazilian filmmaker who took on Bolsonaro. The Brazilian documentary, The Edge of Democracy, has been widely praised. It was even up for an Oscar this past week. But Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro isn't happy about it.
Ficção. Para quem gosta de... do que o urubu come, é um bom filme.
When the film was nominated, Bolsonaro called it, quote, rubbish. He also said he hadn't seen it. Later, his son, who's in politics, described its director, Petra Costa, as a, quote, scumbag. The documentary traces political events in Brazil in recent years, including the impeachment of one president, the imprisonment of another, and the rise of the far-right populist Bolsonaro. It makes the case that Brazil is teetering on the verge of fascism.
I fear our democracy was nothing but a short-lived dream.
Documentary filmmaker Petra Costa began filming her country's elected leaders several years before the 2018 election brought Bolsonaro to power. She's our guest this week. Petra, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Your film is such an intimate portrait of Brazil at the edge of democracy, as the title suggests. But what's particularly striking is how you describe yourself and democracy of Brazil being almost the same age. Can you tell me a little bit about what Brazil felt like when you were a child?
Brazil was coming out of 21 years of dictatorship when I was a child, but I did not see like the weight of what that meant when I was growing up. It was a very optimistic time because democracy was coming back and everyone was really like excited about the future. And they even decided, both parts of the political spectrum in Brazil, to forgive and forget all the crimes committed during the dictatorship. And everyone who had been enemies in the prior years kind of started to talk again, even my grandparents and my parents, who had not been enemies, but my parents had broken away from the family and for a long time. And when I was born was precisely the time that they reunited. But that division reignited in the past few years when there was economic crisis and a huge polarization in society that brought back many of the ghosts from that dictatorship precisely.
Petra, what year were you born?
83.
Let's describe a little bit about your family, because your parents were leftist fighters who went underground. Tell me a little bit about their story.
Yes, my grandparents were part of the elite of the state where I'm from, Minas Gerais, and my grandfather founded one of the major construction companies in the country that grew a lot during the dictatorship and supported the military coup in 64 in fear of like the communist threat. 64, my father went to the United States when he was like 19, and here in New York, he fell in love with books of Marx and Krishnamurti and came back to Brazil wanting to do the revolution. My mother fell in love with him at first sight and also with Marxism. So they went underground fighting against the dictatorship and broke off from the family precisely at that time.
It was a brutal time for people like your parents.
It was. I mean, many of my parents' friends were killed. They were almost killed themselves. They were sent to an action in the Amazon in the late 60s that they didn't go just because my mother was pregnant with my sister. If they had gone, they would also have been killed. So, yes, it was very brutal.
And at one time, your mother was actually imprisoned.
Yes, they were both imprisoned briefly in 68.
And when you say an action in the Amazon, what was an action?
It was a guerrilla inspired in Cuba very much. I mean, there was an idea that if one went to the forest, one could maybe do the revolution as this, like the Cubans did, but I think they weren't taking into account the dimension of Brazil, so it's much harder for that ever to happen there.
The leader, the former president of Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who is popularly known around the world as Lula, he came out of that leftist experience as well, did he not?
Yes. There were many focuses of this leftist resistance in Brazil. Lula became the leader of the workers' movement in São Paulo and actually managed to mobilize the greatest amount of people with protests with hundreds of thousands of people, union workers. And those protests were actually the major blow to the dictatorship.
How did the dictatorship fall in the end?
Well, those protests collaborated with it, and the economic crisis also fell upon the country. And the generals, the military generals themselves, decided to allow for a transition into democracy. And what that meant was that in Congress, they were allowed to vote, whether people would be allowed to vote directly for president. And that happened in 89. In 89, we had our first democratic election after more than 21 years.
But your first election was actually the first time that Lula himself wins, isn't it?
Yes. So Lula runs for president in 89 and loses. The elite goes into panic, thinking that he's a radical leftist, and try to plot many ways for him not to win. And in 94, he runs again and loses. In 98, he runs again and loses. And in 2002, when it seemed already almost impossible, he decides to make a pact with the elite, saying that he won't do anything that will hurt their interests. And he manages to win.
What did it feel like to vote in that 2002 election?
It was amazing. I mean, I had lost hope over all that time that he would ever win. And the fact that he did just was so unbelievable, and the country was really ecstatic. Everyone was in a wave of optimism, and that continued growing until in 2010 when he leaves office. He leaves office with like 87% approval rate. He made a ministry that was so amazing, with leaders protecting the Amazon for many years, like Marina Silva, Gilberto Gil, who was one of our greatest musicians, as the Minister of Culture. It was the best ministry one could have ever thought of. But what was sad was that over time, that pact with the elite had to intensify and ended up in a government that dreamt less and less and had to make more and more concessions.
When you say dreamt less and less, what do you mean by that?
For example, one of the most significant ministers he had was Marina Silva, who was one of the greatest leaders that protected the Amazon. But as soon as he had to make concessions with the oligarch party, PMDB, he had to give more and more rights to like big farmers, monoculture. And also, he ended up opting for a kind of more capitalist way of thinking that did not take sustainability so much into account, did huge dams in the Amazon that most of the indigenous population was against, or all the activists were against, and Marina Silva left the government. And that happened in many sectors. Like, the idealism kept losing for the pragmatic concessions.
And yet he leaves with, as you said, 87% approval rating, and his successor is almost handpicked. Tell me about her.
Yeah, and I mean, just to explain that a little bit, was that in many areas that happened, but in others, the really wonderful things continued to happen. Like, for example, more than 20 million people rose out of misery. Like 40 million people entered the middle class. That was so unbelievable. Like, hunger, which killed 300 children per day, stopped being an issue because of the social programs Lula and his team were able to do. They managed to approve affirmative action. And today, more than half of the students in public universities are Black. I mean, that was unheard of. There would be one, two black students in every university. Now there's more than half. So a silent revolution also happened. That was really what we had dreamed for. And I think that's part of his 87% approval rate. And Dilma, his successor, was his chief of staff. She was kind of his right hand in his government. And he chose her because she was this strong woman and also had an amazing past. She had been a guerrilla fighter. She had been in prison for 2 years, brutally tortured, but had never run for office. But even with that, she won.
And that's Dilma Rousseff you're speaking of, who becomes president after Lula. When she's inaugurated, did you have a sense of optimism then?
I did. I mean, I felt so moved that someone with a past that was so similar to my mother's past actually had reached the presidency. It felt like a true change of times.
Did you grow up hearing stories of torture and imprisonment?
No. You know, many of my parents' friends went through that, but they never speak about it. It's a kind of the silent trauma that no one mentions.
And yet in your film, you introduce your mother to Dilma.
I do. When Dilma was elected, my mother made a list of like 20 things they had in common. They studied in the same school. They were born in the same city. They were imprisoned in the same prison. And I really wanted for these two women to meet. I knew something would come out of that encounter. And after years of already trying to interview Dilma, finally managing to interview Dilma, I then brought my mother to meet her. And it was quite moving. In that meeting, Dilma says to my mother that she actually never wanted to be president. It was not her desire. It was something that Lula made happen, but not really her choice.
Why did she not want to?
Because she was like the most efficient chief of staff, like behind the curtains kind of actor, good at managing, but doesn't love the camera, doesn't like to be filmed at all, doesn't like to do small talk, doesn't like to please people. And that is like 90%, I think, of a president's job, which she didn't like to do.
When did you begin to sense that her approval rating was slipping?
In 2013. So she's elected in 2010, takes office in 2011. And for the first 2 years of her mandate, she has like the highest approval rate than any other president in Brazilian history. And then in June 2013, these protests explode kind of out of nowhere a little bit against a rise of 20 cents in the bus fare. In a few weeks, these protests that had begun for progressive reasons actually are kind of hijacked by a new far right that is born out of social media precisely during those weeks. And the national Brazilian media also manages to portray these protests as if they were against the government. And in less than 3 weeks, her approval rate goes from like 70% to 30%. So she has a like 40% drop in her approval rate because of protests that weren't even against her to begin with.
What were those protests? What did they feel like in the streets? Did you feel them walk each day? Were they in each city? Were they particular cities?
They were all over the country. I mean, most massively in São Paulo and Rio. But it was our first protests that were organized and led by social media. So suddenly they could happen at the same time in the entire country. I mean, in the 80s, it would take much longer, you know. And everyone was for the first time putting their picture in the streets with a plaque, written things. And like it became this social media phenomenon. But they were very chaotic. Like people were protesting all different types of things at the same time. They were protesting for no World Cup, for no Olympics, for more health, for more education, against the media. And because of that chaos, it was easy for the far right to start to hijack the narrative. And that's what they started to do in the beginning of 2013 and continued doing until the election of Bolsonaro. Because also the left had been in power for 13 years, it was easy for the far right to show themselves as the real revolution.
Dilma Rousseff also angers the bankers. What happens then?
Yes. So just before these protests, Dilma had done a move that is a hard move to do in Brazil. We have one of the highest interest rates in the world, and that's how many of the rich people make money there. And she reduced the interest rates and started to piss off the elite in a way that Lula had never done. Lula was always quite managed to please both the working class and the elite. And Dilma starts to be more confrontational with the Brazilian elite. And slowly that starts to lead into a revolt against her by that elite.
The world is changing in ways that affect your life and your business. Do you have the intelligence you need? Now, FP is offering Insider. With a new FP Insider subscription, you will get all of FP's content plus exclusive access to data-driven intelligence, power maps that distill complex issues, in-depth special reports, and conference calls on the biggest stories and trends. Get global insight you can bank on. Subscribe to FP Insider today at foreignpolicy.com/FP Insider.
So the revolt against her from the elites then begins sometime after these protests.
She had reduced the interest rates before the protests, so I think it had started before, and they continue throughout the protests. And then in 2014, elections take place. And you have a candidate who's called Aécio Neves running against her, and he is a representative of the Brazilian elite somehow. I mean, his grandfather had run for president and became the first Brazilian president after the dictatorship in 85. It was an internal election, so he was elected by the Congress. And Aécio Neves from PSDB, which is like a center-right party in Brazil. And the entire elite aligns with Aécio Neves against Dilma for that election. The entire media and a lot of these new far-right kind of social media groups as well. And everyone thinks that Aécio Neves is going to win. But of course, Dilma has the government in her hands and most of the northeast of the country that has benefited from all these social programs. And it's a very tight race. The race as well that is highly funded by construction companies that will later be all involved in car wash operation. But Dilma wins that election by a very small difference, like 4%. And her opponent decides not to recognize her victory. I mean, the day after her election, all these far-right social media groups start asking already for her impeachment, and a narrative that she needs to be impeached is established kind of straight away.
So her opponent does not recognize that she's won. Indeed.
Exactly. I mean, as most political scientists right today, like one of the main things you need for a democracy to thrive is the idea that you will recognize the winner and learn how to lose. And they do not do that. And Aécio Neves started a movement to impeach her, and they started looking for a crime that would fit into that desire. And the crime they found was that she had done what they call fiscal makeup or budget maneuvering, which is an attempt to hide the deficit that had been done by her government because of the economic crisis. But it's not really a high crime and misdemeanor. It's something that was very hard for anyone to understand what that actually was. It took months for me to understand, only when I entered into Congress and started interviewing all the lawyers and congressmen that I understood. And most jurists have come to the conclusion that it's not a high crime and misdemeanor that would rise to the level of an impeachable crime.
When does that impeachment process begin?
In March 2016, which is precisely when I start filming.
And there's a moment in that filming where you ask various congressmen about her, and one of them says that she didn't know how to work the room well. She didn't give enough hugs.
Yes, that was what so many congressmen told me, that Dilma didn't give them attention, that she didn't give them hugs, that she didn't visit them, that she didn't send telegrams to thank them for how they were voting, and was not inviting them to the presidential palace, were not taking pictures with him. I mean, that's one of the main reasons why they voted for her impeachment. But there was another graver reason that only became clear months later, which was that car wash operation, which was the greatest corruption investigation in Brazil's history, that uncovered a systemic corruption, which is private construction companies had organized a payback system with political parties to finance elections. And that had been going on since the 60s in Brazil, but had never been uncovered. And car wash operation managed to finally uncover that. And the entire political system in Brazil became exposed. And they managed to start for the first time putting these businessmen and politicians in jail. So you had owners and presidents of these major construction companies going to prison, as well as several politicians. So as soon as these politicians start going to jail, all congressmen in Brasilia go desperate because their elections had all been financed through this corruption system. So they all could go to jail as soon as they lose their mandate. And so they go into despair. And that, I think, is the main reason why they plot Dilma's impeachment, because Dilma was not stopping the operation from happening.
And explain for us one more time, the impeachment itself was around a sort of fudging of the books. It's something that is quite complicated, but explain it one more time. And how did you come to understand it?
Yes, the president has more or less under her control several like public banks, and they can put money from one into the other. So what she did was she took money from one of those banks and put into the government's account to hide the deficit, to pretend before the election that the government was not in the bad shape that it actually was.
She's just sort of moving money around between accounts to make it look like one account has more in it than it does.
Exactly.
Okay. And as the impeachment process unfolds, you're there filming everything.
Yes. So we managed to get into the Congress and film the entire impeachment trial, like from the lower house until the Senate, all the conversations, all the testimonials, all the speeches from the lawyers on both sides. And it is quite impressive because it was so clear to me how much of a theater it all was. All the parties knew who they were going to vote much before the process ever started.
To what degree do you think misogyny played a role in that impeachment process?
Oh, it was a huge role. In so many of the moments that I was able to film, it felt like this horde of white men just reclaiming a space that they thought had always belonged to them. And they could not hide the euphoria and the ecstasy in their faces in that taking back. I mean, it felt kind of like a French Revolution in reverse.
What did it feel like for you being in that space, filming those men, filming that euphoria?
It was despairing. It was crazy because every single moment, like every vote that they won, would have as a soundtrack fireworks. So today when I hear fireworks, I get a bit traumatized because they were like almost sadistically celebrating that reclaim of power. I don't know. I thought naively that history would progress slowly but surely, like that these secular inequalities that had shaped so much of Brazilian history as well as the history of the United States were both countries shaped by slavery and indigenous genocide, that we would be able to continuously reverse those inequalities. And suddenly the reverse was happening. Like we were going back like more than 50 years.
There's an incredible moment in the back of a car where you're sitting with Dilma, and she says that she feels like Joseph K., the character in Kafka.
Yes, because it was hard for her to understand what crime she was accused of, just as Joseph K. And also, there's a line in Joseph K. that I think she also identified with. It was like, the judgment doesn't take place in the trial room. It takes place in the corridors, in the houses of the judges. And that's where they decide. That's where all the decision is made. And what characterizes a good lawyer, Kafka also writes, is his contacts with the judges. It's not his ability to interpret the law.
And the contact with judges actually goes into the next phase of your film, which is when Car Wash continues, Sergio Moro, the prosecutor, brings in Lula himself. And as a prosecutor, he ends up becoming trial judge. But Lula himself is implicated in car wash. What is he implicated for?
That was also something very hard to understand. But the accusation was that Lula had accepted an apartment in exchange for favors. However, what became clear the further we investigated was that Lula visited that apartment once, did not have the key to that apartment, never slept in the apartment, never truly accepted the apartment. He was offered it, but it was never clear if he was accepting it or not. And based on the fact that he had visited that apartment, even though there was no other evidence that the apartment was really his, they convicted him to first 9, then 12 years in prison.
You're there with Lula when he receives that sentence, and he tries to turn himself in, and what happens?
It was the most dramatic moment of the 3 years where we filmed. I was actually on my way to Rio from São Paulo. I was in the airport ready to get into the plane when I get a message in my phone, like an alert from like the headline of a newspaper saying that Lula had been convicted and Moro had just ordered his prison. So I stop. I don't enter into the plane. I lose my flight. I start writing to everyone. I discover that Lula is on his way to the union where he started his career in the 80s. So I get a taxi and go there and manage to get into the building. My crew meets me with the equipment and we start filming. And when we see we're kind of kidnapped, it felt like being kidnapped 3 days inside this building where Lula was kind of in custody, because if he left, he would be in prison, so he couldn't leave the union. And the entire country was looking at the union through, like, there were helicopters all over filming. And from inside, we would watch from the TV all these helicopters filming the building. And there was so much tension because Lula didn't know. For 3 days, he didn't know if he was going to give himself into prison or if he would resist. And finally, he decides to give himself in, to abide by the rule of law. And he says that to the crowd, and the crowd starts crying. And when he leaves the building, everyone surrounds the building and holds the gate to prevent him from leaving.
In that moment, what did you think the future looked like for Brazil, with so many people trying to prevent Lula from turning himself in, and one half the country supporting the imprisonment of a former president?
It was the culmination of this 3 years of kind of somehow a type of civil war between the two sides of society, and their side had won. And I use this sentence in the film. I use a Warren Buffett quote that says, yes, there's class warfare, and our class, the rich class, is winning. And that's what became clear at that moment.
So Lula was actually running again for president after the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, and he is well ahead in the polls. And then his imprisonment keeps him from running. Is that correct?
Yes. So Lula was very well ahead in the polls. He is imprisoned by Sergio Moro, the judge that oversees car wash operation, orders his imprisonment. And with that, he's not allowed to run for president. And Bolsonaro, who was a congressman that was kind of obscure in Congress and became known for defending kind of homophobic, misogynistic, anti-indigenous, racist comments, becomes a candidate and starts growing a lot because he is charismatic in a way similar but different to Lula. And many people that were going to vote for Lula decide to vote for Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro wins. And the first thing he does after he wins is to announce that his Minister of Justice is going to be Sergio Moro, precisely the judge that put Lula in prison.
Petra, your film has been criticized by the current government.
Yes. After the nomination to the Oscars, Bolsonaro said that our film was a fiction. And then the reporters asked, but have you seen it? And he said, no, but it's crap. And his Secretary of Culture also said that the film should be in the category of fiction and fantasy. And the strange thing was that 4 days after that, that same Secretary of Culture plagiarizes Goebbels, Hitler's Minister of Propaganda, in a speech. And in that speech, Hitler's favorite opera is playing in the background. That Secretary of Culture is fired the next day after the embassy of Israel and Germany ask for his dismissal. But it just reveals so much of the DNA of the government.
Pedro, how else has your film been received outside of the government in Brazil? How have people received it?
It's been wonderful. I mean, the film was the second most watched documentary on Netflix in 2019, which really surpassed all our expectations. And there's like one tweet every few minutes about the film, and it has shaped a lot of the conversations. And I have had thousands of messages of people saying like, I'm so sorry, I supported the impeachment, and your film made me reflect on how wrong I was or how brainwashed I was. Or people that say, I hadn't been speaking to my best friend for years, and after seeing your film, we finally came back together feeling empathy for our different political visions. So it has created dialogue between the two political sides that identify with the division inside my own family and with the trauma as well that I expose in the film, the political grief that I tell in the first person, which I think so many Brazilians felt regardless of their political identifications.
Petra, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was documentary filmmaker Petra Costa. Her film, The Edge of Democracy, was nominated for an Oscar. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with help from Dan Haverty. Our editor is Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. If you like this episode, hit subscribe on that podcast app, and then come back next week. We'll have a new episode.
The world is changing in ways that affect your life and your business. Do you have the intelligence you need? Now, FP is offering Insider. With a new FP Insider subscription, you will get all of FP's content plus exclusive access to data-driven intelligence, power maps that distill complex issues, in-depth special reports, and conference calls on the biggest stories and trends. Get global insight you can bank on. Subscribe to FP Insider today at foreignpolicy.com/FP Insider.